and welcome to this latest episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast hosted by Data Protection People. My name is Ollie Rear, and I am joined for the purposes of this intro by Carrie James. Hello, Carrie.
Hi, Ollie.
How are you doing?
I'm good. I really enjoyed that session again. I think I say this every time, but I really enjoyed it.
Don't worry, it's what Dave and I say every week when we get on this, is we really enjoy that. But the thing is, we do really enjoy it. So, yeah. You know, what are we supposed to say? We're just going to have to come up with synonyms for we really enjoyed that, or that was a good one, clearly. But yes, fabulous episode this week. So we did, what did we do? We did a little bit about what's been in the news. And then the reason that you joined us is because we did...
Retention, part
That's
two.
That's right.
Retention archiving, part two.
We did part two to our retention and archiving chat from a few weeks ago, which I think went down very well at the time. And I believe this second episode also went down relatively well. So for reference, if you've not heard either of them, I obviously encourage you to go and listen to the first episode. It will help, generally speaking, I think, in terms of the conversation that we have here. I think it's important to point out that first episode, we spoke a lot about archiving specifically, and we talked actually about what we mean by archiving, what archiving actually is, didn't we, Carrie? Because there's a lot of misconceptions around what it actually means.
Yeah, I think that first episode was sort of, a lot of it was centered on terminology.
Yes, that's right.
Whereas this one today has been more practically, how do you deal with a records management program? How do you start tackling it? And do we give away the conclusion of how to tackle it? Do we let people find out in the podcast?
I'm tempted to let people find out on the podcast, but I couldn't have said it better myself. That's exactly how we broke it down. We spoke practically today, didn't we? You know,
yeah.
There are a number of solutions, a number of approaches that we discussed. We also spoke a lot about some of the resources that might be out there. Now, there were lots of links in the chat, which is an incentive for you to come and join live. If there's anything that you hear on today's session and you can't find the links for, come and join us live. You know, it's a lot of fun, and you get it all in real time. Obviously, if there's a specific resource you want, obviously just reach out to us on the socials and we can point you in the right direction. But I'm trying to generate interest in the podcast. Come down to us live. We had, I think, around 70 odd people today, which, considering that it's the second week of June and a lot of people on holiday, is quite extraordinary numbers. So we're extremely grateful to our not so little community anymore of practitioners and GDPR geeks like myself. Generally speaking, we've got a fabulous little community, and in another good episode that they all contributed to. We also spoke a little bit about what was in the news, didn't we, Carrie?
Yes, there was a couple of interesting news stories. They're both sort of centred around different sort of breaches, confidentiality. So they would have been good for the breaches podcasts.
Yeah.
But I found them for this week instead.
Oh, well, I'm sure we'll make it do. Now, this is the... unless I know anything contrary to this, I think this is the last time you're joining us for perhaps the foreseeable, Carrie. Obviously, you're not being forced out, but...
I'll try come up with another good topic, shall I? Because I'll try think of another topic we can chat about. Do another two-parter or something.
Yes, absolutely. But you very kindly come and help me out over the past few weeks, particularly with Dave being away, because I'm sure the listeners don't want to listen to me monologue for an hour, even though I do enough of that as it stands. So thank you very much for your time over the past few weeks. I've very much enjoyed all of our episodes. The one episode that you weren't on, and I feel like we should plug because maybe it didn't necessarily get the coverage it deserved, was over the bank holiday weekend. Obviously, we were all away, sunning ourselves, generally speaking, having a lovely old time of it. David and I actually did record an episode that week. It was a pre-recorded one. We got on a private little session and kicked around a few things. And actually, it ended up being a really, really interesting conversation. There are a couple of things in there in particular which I would urge you to go and listen back to, because we think it's, particularly relevant considering the direction that the ICO is taking, which we touched on a little bit today in the news, Carrie, and the way that things are shaping up under John Edwards, which I think is a really interesting thing to look at. Last thing before we let you get stuck into this episode, a couple of points to plug. So we'll be back next week with an episode of GDPR Radio, the open surgery type session. So do come along, ask any questions you've got, share some feedback, some experiences. You know, it's always a fabulous opportunity for us to get together and kick around these topics. And then the week after that, we have another themed session, which is going to be excellent. We are talking ransomware attacks with Assured Data Protection. Stuart Parkin will be joining us for that chat, so that will be excellent. We always love having guests on. They've always got fabulous insights, so I'm very much looking forward to that. If you want to find out about what's coming up in future sessions, pick the ones that you maybe want to attend, although you should attend all of them because they're all great. You can find the full list on the DPP website on the events page. It's all up there. You can also jot down your details to sign up and get an invite to the live sessions. Again, I would highly recommend joining live because you get a lot of the insights from the chat, a lot of the links, etc. And you get the opportunity to drop in any questions that you might have. So I think it's a particularly useful resource. On that note, Carrie, anything else before we let the listeners go?
No, it's been lovely to join you for all these sessions, and I will definitely be back at some point.
Yes, you're expected to be back.
I know, I think it's going to be tied into my actual job description at some point.
It's tied into mine, so it's only a matter of time. And it's tied into producer Miles's, who's not said anything today because he's a bit poorly. So we'll let him get off and continue his recovery. Carrie, thank you very much for your time and insights. Listeners, we hope you enjoy this episode. We'll be back next week. Until then, enjoy this episode. Right, Carrie, let's talk a little bit, just quickly, because I think there's not too much to discuss. But a little bit about what's been in the news. You've sent me two items. I don't know if you want to start with either of those.
Yeah, I was quite chuffed for myself this week finding stuff for the news. I know last time I was on this, I came with nothing. Sometimes I have stuff, sometimes I don't. I think, shall we start with the ICO one? Because I found that, I think this is going to be really interesting. I'm actually quite looking forward to this. I mean, I'll admit, okay, so I brought this today, but it's one of my clients that told me about this, sent me the link. So I'm not going to claim total credit over this one. But
okay.
The ICO had a FOI request asking them how many reprimands they've given to organisations for data breaches. And apparently the ICO are actually supposed to be publishing these reprimands according to their policy, but they haven't been publishing them, but they're going to start publishing them. So for me,
right.
I'm really excited to see these when they go online, because I'm quite nosy, so I'd like to see what other organisations have been getting up to with breaches and stuff. I really like how they publish the FOI decision notices. And if you do FOI quite a lot, I found them like really useful to go and look, see how other bits been, you know, how have exemptions worked when it's gone to the ICO. So I think if they start publishing reprimands for breaches, I think it'll be quite interesting. It'll be quite an interesting read, especially if they go into the sort of detail on their website when they publish it, as they do when they send the reprimand back to the clients.
Yeah, so just so we're all in alignment on this, what do you mean by reprimand?
So they've been given a slap on the wrist. They've been given a slap on the wrist, basically, because most of the time when you have a data breach with the ICO, a lot of the time you'll get a no further action, but please consider, you know, updating your training, checking your policies, recirculating reminders, things like that. Like, it's quite a generic email you get back from them if you have a red, like not a, a serious data breach, but nothing too terrible.
Sure.
Reprimand, from what I've seen with the ones, like I know of two of them that have had reprimands, I know the sort of stories behind them. They have been more serious, but more harm, but it's a reprimand as in, you know, we're reprimanding you of you doing the things. And then obviously the one above that is if they should be fining people, which I think they do publish anyway, don't they, as their enforcement type things. But the reprimands, I've not seen many in my time. I've seen one that I've had that I've seen this week from a client, but then I've also know of one from a different place. But I think it'll be really interesting when they start publishing these.
Just a little bit. Feedback, but no, I agree with you, and I think ultimately all of this. I don't know if you listen to mine and Dave's pre-recorded episode last week, but we spoke about the ICO's opinion on certain law enforcement practices. I'd urge you to go back and listen to that. Dave and I had a fantastic chat, but one of the things mainly that we spoke about was how important and how refreshing it is to have some transparency and some action on these things, which I guess is kind of what you're getting at to a certain extent. You're saying, you know, it's really useful to be able to actually have some oversight of this and what's being said and what's being done. Just for reference, we mentioned that this meeting is being recorded. That privacy notice is now on screen, albeit a little bit delayed. Thanks for bearing with us. So, yeah, I completely agree with you, Carrie. As I say, I'd urge listeners to go and listen to the episode we did last week with Dave, because we spoke about something relatively similar. But, yeah, I tend to agree with you. It's very useful and I think refreshing, because without wanting to be too critical of our previous commissioner, there was at times a feeling perhaps that there was maybe a lack of communication and transparency on some of these issues. So,
yeah,
anything from that perspective, I think, is useful.
Yeah, and I think that, like, while they do a great job of FOI and making it clear this is what they find acceptable and not, I think with data breaches and subject access requests, sometimes you're a little bit swimming in the dark of what are they expecting to see, like, what would they count as serious, what would they not count as serious, and I think seeing some of these things will give people a better idea, because they don't really publish much guidance on these types of things. And if you have a subject access request that goes to the ICO, the response and outcome of that isn't published. And so I find it trickier to sort of gauge them or apply exemptions to certain bits, because there's no benchmark to go against, unless you have your own benchmark of, well, this is what they've said to us in the past about this similar situation.
Yeah.
But you've got to have enough of a volume of that stuff yourself going through there, and enough breaches yourself and enough SARs yourself to sort of have that volume that you might have enough from the ICO to do that yourself. But if you're not really getting much of either, it's sort of a little bit in the dark each time. But I think this will be really interesting. I don't know when they're going to start publishing them, and I don't know if they're going to backdate any of it, or if they'll just decide, okay, we'll start publishing from the 1st of July, and anything after the 1st of July will be put on the website, but everybody else before that gets a free pass and gets to keep their, you know, data breaches hidden a bit longer.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Funnily enough, I really would like to sort of echo a point you made there when you were talking about that, which was, you were sort of saying the idea that sometimes it's useful to have this, just because sometimes you feel a little bit in the dark, even though there's guidance out there and there's plenty of guidance, but sometimes it's helpful to have that extra layer of interpretation.
Yeah.
And actually, I had an anecdote from my work from this week. I had an instance, actually it was last week, but doesn't matter, where the ICO basically had been sent a DPIA for consultation by one of my client's customers. And we were basically asked to respond to some of their questions. And one of the things they did is they picked through a DPA that I had reviewed and contributed to for the client. And one of the things they picked out is we'd put in a very specific type of clause to do with representatives and liabilities. And they basically looked at that and put a question to us and said, you know, on what basis have you produced this? And do you think it's compatible with a specific requirement under Article 27? Please could you provide us with some information? And I basically, you know, responded and said, this is why we think it works. This is how we think it works, just to be clear, X, Y, Z. However, please do let us know if you feel otherwise, because we will happily take your steer on this. And it was just a nice opportunity to get a bit of feedback. And I am hoping that they do provide me with some feedback on that, because it's a very specific type of clause I've not used before. And I would most welcome their contribution. So, yeah, no, I completely agree with what you're saying, in terms of sometimes you do feel like you're either in the dark or in a bit of an echo chamber, and it's useful to have that sort of window to how they're interpreting things.
It's like the ICO has guidance for things, but sometimes I think some of it's a little bit on the more vague side, because we all know the ICO likes to be a little bit hedgy on things, like what makes a complex SAR. Well, they don't really set it out very prescriptive. So, again, it's kind of like hedging it a little bit, but it would be interesting if they ever published things where people had challenged the use of an extension on complexity, for them to see whether they actually agreed with the complexity of reasons or not. But they don't publish that kind of thing.
Yeah, and this is
sort
where
of those
Phil
things where it could be really useful if they publish more.
Yeah, and this is where Phil would challenge you on this and say that's what's brilliant about working in this area, is that there is so much grey area and it's down to us, which I don't think we necessarily all agree with Phil on that point. Sometimes it's quite nice to have something prescriptive. I don't know if there's anything else on that, but just to just because I want to get into our main topic, and so let's work through the rest of these news items. I don't know if you want to talk about this safeguarding story
I came across it and I thought it was quite interesting, because I think it's a good reminder that, you know, it's not just what you're doing in the office and stuff, but when you're out and about working. So this is a safeguarding head at a private school, expensive looking private school as well, was having a very loud phone conversation on the train discussing personal details about pupils and giving first names and talking about sensitive issues like their health. I think there's mental health and things like that. And it just so happened there was a journalist a few seats away from him listening into this, taking notes, and obviously has made a story out of it. And I think he's been suspended now.
Deary me. So I'm sure that's literally the plot line of an episode at the thick of it. But yeah, I mean, that's quite extraordinary.
Yeah, because I know sort of I'll say to people, like, be careful of who, you know, be aware of who could see your laptops. If you're working on a train on a laptop, be aware of who could see your screen. If you're working in a coffee shop, but, you know, be aware. We always talk about being aware of your surroundings like that. But, like, this is on a phone, and maybe they sort of thought that they could get away with it a little bit more, but then they were also wearing the lanyard. Mm. And, like, for me, when I worked with councils, I had a lanyard, and I was always told, don't wear it when you're out the office. You know, as soon as you're out the office, take it off. Don't wear it. You know, don't make it publicly, you know, don't go into town wearing my lanyard of who I work for and what I do.
Yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, we've often kicked around this concept of, you know, if you're discussing something, is it, I mean, it's a particularly niche and arbitrary conversation possibly to have, but if you're discussing a data subject, if you're, you know, sharing data effectively, mm-hmm. but just over the phone, is that technically processing, therefore is it technically a breach, etc. But I think sometimes we do run the risk of getting a little bit bogged down in those conversations where it's important to just set out, because obviously none of this has been reported as a, at least as far as I'm aware, as a data protection issue. It's being reported as a safeguarding issue, right? Which it is, because if you're the safeguarding lead, frankly, you should know better, and it's pretty damaging to your own, you know, CV, I suppose, to have been suspended or dismissed for this type of thing, because really you should be aware that there's a confidentiality there and that you shouldn't be discussing these things in public. But yeah, no, I think it's interesting to frame the conversation in that light and maybe say, look, let's leave aside discussions of is it a breach, is it not a breach, and instead, you know, just look at the facts of it, which is that you shouldn't be doing this because anyone could be listening on the train. So I think you're right, and it is a really useful reminder in that context.
The thing is, it might not be the first time that he's done this. If he gets the train to and from work, he might have, like, multiple conversations like this, and it's just bad luck this day there was a journalist listening in. But in my experience, you know, it doesn't always take a journalist. Sometimes you do get members of the public calling up saying, I heard this person talking on the train or the bus or whatever, and they were talking about this. So it's not completely unheard of that a third party overhearing stuff feels like they do need to tell somebody about it.
I mean, and you know, it could be anyone on the train. Could be a parent, could be the kid that's being discussed. You never know. It's pretty easy to wander onto the train and not notice someone that you would normally recognise. So, yeah, no,
if he's commuting in and out of the school doing that, then there's every chance that there could be pupils or parents commuting in and out on the same train.
Yeah, no, for sure. Google data breach call overheard on private school train. Thanks for the heads up. Yeah, I don't know if that's the same thing that we're discussing, Adrian. But yeah, we can pop a link in.
I'll pop the link in. I've got it open now.
Yeah, no worries. Right, just one last piece of news, I think, from me. I've seen a lot of conversations this morning about the layoffs at OneTrust. Now, I'm only hearing things secondhand and through the grapevine, so at this stage I don't necessarily want to comment on them because I don't feel like I've got all the information to hand, but we will probably address that next week more information becomes available to me.
All I've seen is the odd little post on LinkedIn, which is probably what you've seen.
Yeah, and as I say, I try and avoid commenting on anything until I've got a bit of a picture built up, but of course, you know, it's terrible to hear that people are losing their jobs. There was one point I wanted to pick up, and again, not a particularly fun one, but a quite extraordinary one. It was I've been seeing a lot of chat on the socials about the accuracy principle over the last week. I think some of that possibly, and I'm sure some here will echo this, which is that, you know, because we live in quite a niche ecosystem, I think in the privacy landscape, particularly when you come on the socials, you tend to have the same topics come up a lot. But anyway, that's just a by the by. I've seen a lot of chat about accuracy. And on this note, I wanted to refer people, if they haven't seen it, to a story which Tim Turner shared on his DPO Daily feed, which is a fantastic resource, this week, about a story relating to a guy in America who was jailed for over 2 weeks because of an accuracy issue. Now, the story itself is pretty horrifying. Basically, the guy was getting a flight. Someone else at that time in the airport shoplifted, caught on CCTV. They both got then the same flight out of the airport, I think. And when airport security went to the airline to get a list of passengers, someone decided that they were only going to give over the details of this one passenger because they thought it looked like him, based on CCTV footage. Based on that, an arrest warrant was put out for the guy, and something like 6 months later, he's arrested and thrown in jail for 2 weeks, at no point told any of the warrants against him. It's just an extraordinary and quite horrifying story, which I would still encourage people to read, because you talk about real-world implications of accuracy problems. It's quite extraordinary that it got to that point. And I think there is probably a fair case to say that a lot of that is probably less of a data protection issue, and a lot of the issues that the poor gentleman faced were to do with the American legal system and the way that they do things. But nonetheless, you know, that when you're talking about impact of accuracies, it's hard to do more significant than that sort of thing. So a really interesting story, and I just thought I'd signpost people to that, because it really sort of has stuck with me, quite frankly. Anything else, Carrie, from a news perspective that you want to talk about before we get into some retention chat?
I've not seen anything, but you are right. I've seen a little bit of accuracy stuff going on today on LinkedIn. So, but I think it is, like you say, small world, so we all tend to start talking about the same things.
Yes. I think that tends to be the case. So let's talk about retention. We spent a lot of time on the last session, and if you've not heard it, guys, I do urge you to go back and listen to the first episode that we did. We had a really good chat, but we spent a lot of time, didn't we, Carrie, talking about what we mean by archiving, because, well, first of all, by way of an introduction for those that weren't with us on that first chat, you've obviously got a background in records management and archiving, but I think one of the things that we really wanted to get across was this idea that often the term archiving is used incorrectly, in a sort of interchangeable way with storage, with moving information assets between sort of different environments, between, you know, often people will say, oh, it's been archived, but it's not really, you know, it's just that your emails have been put in a different place.
Yeah,
they've been deleted or whatever. Archive
is always seems to be used as a very blanket term of, we'll put it in this other folder and we'll call it the archive, and then we'll maybe delete it at some point in the future when we think about it.
And we're all guilty of it. I mean, I have dozens of archive folders, but then again, I don't claim that I'm actually archiving anything. So we spent a lot of time talking about that last episode because we felt it was really important, first of all, to get that across, but also to really drive home, I think, the implications of archiving specifically, because if you're going to do it, you may as well do it properly. And then we sort of had a broader conversation about, well, how does this tie in? How does this misconception, I suppose, let's call it, tie into some of the other pitfalls maybe around retention? And I think what we ended the conversation with, talking about some more practical and tangible elements, and also focusing on what, you know, our bag, which is ultimately personal data and the retention of that, as opposed to just necessarily records management on the whole. And I thought today a good place to start would maybe to focus in on retention a little bit more specifically. And one of the places I wanted to begin with, although Carrie, obviously if there's anything that you want to bring up from last time, then please do, but I think the place I wanted to start was really sort of how do you go about getting compliant with the retention principle, basically, if you're starting from scratch. Because I think it's worth elaborating on this. a lot of time when I engage with an organization, and I don't know if this is a shared experience across, you know, the sector or with other colleagues, but I do tend to come into organizations and it's one of the things where it's sort of last on the agenda almost, retention. You know, it's like, oh, we'll focus in on these bits. We'll get our privacy notices up today. Oh, we'll leave retention. Or maybe there's bits and pieces. Certain departments do, you know, have retention criteria in place, but there's nothing really holistic there. So I guess, sorry, I don't know if you can say something, Kerry, but that's kind of where I wanted to start is, so if you are coming at it fresh, where do you begin? How do you get the ball rolling on this? Because it's a mammoth project, right, to take an entire organization, try and apply, first of all, determine retention criteria and then apply it across the whole organization. Mm-hmm. So if that works for you, that's kind of where I wanted to start.
Yeah, no, that's fine. I mean, you're right. I find that retention is usually, I'll ask a client, so where do you think you are with your retention? And they're always a bit like, you know, it's like, okay. Like, everybody seems to be in the same boat with retention, I feel, as well. I haven't come across anybody who's completely hot on retention. What I find generally is that some particular areas of business are better than others. So finance are usually fine. They seem to be really good with, you know, getting rid of stuff. But I don't know if that's just because finance have very easy to identify retention periods, perhaps. And that's why it makes it easier for them. And HR are usually pretty good as well, in my experience. Those two areas are usually the ones that if a company says, yeah, we do retention, those generally are the two areas that do it. And it's the rest of the business that's a bit more unsure about what it's got and what it's doing about it.
Yeah, sure. I mean, that probably stems from two things, right? Which is one, the volume of records. So if you're a business that has a large customer base, then obviously, you know, from purely proportionate to that, finance and HR are likely going to have fewer records to look after, or at least fewer personal data records anyway.
Yeah.
And as you say, secondly, they're more tightly regulated and they'll probably have more accessible and clearly defined retention criteria. So,
yeah,
you know, particularly finance, but obviously HR as well, probably where it comes from. But no, I do completely agree with you. And this is one of the questions I wanted to ask, first of all, and I suppose this question goes both to you, Kerry, but also to the audience, if anyone's got any experience to share on this. But is it the case, we think, that an organization has to be sort of sufficiently mature in the first place to be able to undertake this? Because, and I guess this is sort of chicken and egg, right? I'm saying that, you know, a lot of organizations leave it till last, but also, is it the case that you have to have a certain level of maturity? Because I find it quite difficult to conceive that you would be able to appropriately tackle retention unless you had at least a sort of sufficient overview of an organization's data, of their processing, of their systems, just broadly of their ecosystem, right? Because otherwise, how are you going to go about it? Now, I don't know, maybe that's just from my experience, but I tend to think that you need to have that overview first, whether it's, you know, you've compiled ROPAs or you've got asset registers or you've gone through the process of doing actual data mapping. I don't know, but let's be honest, it's going to be quite hard unless you've got that overview to apply. Well, because what are you applying your retention criteria to and how are you determining them if you don't have that level of information? I don't know, maybe that's...
I think it's actually easier to start if you are a small organisation or you're a young organisation. You know, you can identify that the data you've been creating, the documents you've got, that actually none of it's going to be up for retention soon because, you know, maybe all needing to be kept for 6 years or whatever. But I think it's quite good if you can get on top of it before then, get your policies in place, get your systems in, because I know some systems can automate deletion of data. Get all of that in place, get everything in place. So then when that first, you know, time comes up where things should start being deleted, it should do it. And you shouldn't ever really have the backlog that I see a lot of organisations having where they have years upon years worth of data or they've got, you know, storage units with paper records and they don't really know what's in there or how old it is or even what condition it's in sometimes. So I think if you can sort of get all the, you know, the policy and the procedures in place ahead of time, I think it's a lot less work. I think it's more work if you wait until you've got stuff to do to then go backwards, because then you're going backwards to do the stuff that's backlogged that shouldn't be there now anyway. So you kind of, you know, not really compliant with data protection principles about retention there. But then once you tackle that lot, in theory, you're going to have the lot that's already needs to be potentially deleted and gotten rid of while you've been dealing with the first lot, depending on how long it's taking you.
But no, for sure.
It sort of is the way a lot of, like, especially with a lot of our clients and things, they're, you know, housing associations have been going for quite a while, holding a lot of data. It can be difficult for them to unpick it from the other end if they've not been keeping on top of it in the first place.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I think you bang on that point, which is that, you know, if you are coming to it late, effectively, you're tasked with two things, which is one, establishing your criteria and your mechanisms going forwards, but you're also at the same time trying to quote unquote stop the rot, right?
Yeah.
Which is way more difficult than just getting it in place in the first place. I mean, I came up against this the other day because you're right, particularly, so as listeners will know, we work a lot with housing associations. They're going for generally quite a long time, if not in their current form, through mergers, etc., which I'll come back to in just a second because Ben's left quite an interesting comment. But they've been generally going for a certain length of time. But I was recently working with one of our new customers, a charity client, and we were working through it, and I sort of outlined a retention period that was a relatively long one, maybe 10 years or something like that, because it was to do with safeguarding. And they were like, oh, yeah, that's fine. They're like, oh, well, you know, we're not going to have to worry about that because we've not been going for long enough. And for some reason, it seemed ludicrous to me that that was the case because, you know, experience of dealing with housing providers who have been going for a very long time. But yeah, that's exactly what you're getting at, right? Which is that if you set it now, it's a lot easier. You don't have to worry about it. If you say, well, your safeguarding referrals are retained for 10 years and deleted after that, well, in some cases, you might have, you know, nigh on 10 years to get ready for it because you know, there's so much running time.
Yeah, and like the comments that David Smith made in the chat, you know, start pulling it from Europa, create your retention schedule out of that, because in Europa, you can have, you know, this is your retention point of how long we need to keep all these items for. This is where we've got it from. Use that as your starting point to then create your schedule out of that and create your policies out of that. So you can have that information note there. You might not have, you know, you're creating the policy might not be the priority if you still need to do privacy notices and training and all these other bits. But, you know, get it in there before the first lot of retention sort of comes up, and you shouldn't end up in, you know, shouldn't end up so bogged down in trying to solve it.
Yeah, there are a couple of good points in the chat here. One of them, I suppose we touched on last week, which is the idea that you're not the first to tackle this issue. There's loads of resources out there, really, really good resources in some cases. If you're a housing provider, the National Housing Federation have got good resources, at least as a starting point. Ian's pointing out that as a Scottish local authority, there are some really good resources as well from two Scottish sources. One looks like the government and one is Scottish Archives. So there's stuff out there for you to start. That's the thing, because I think we mentioned this previously, but one of the number one things that I struggle with, maybe not one of the number one, but something that I do struggle with whenever I'm asked is, you know, I'm the DPO. Someone comes to me and says, oh, I've got this specific asset. How long do I keep it for? And I sort of go, I don't know. How long do you need it for? You know, they say, oh, well, we have to keep it for X long because there's a you know, legal obligation to do so. So, well, there you go. There's your retention period. But also, just quickly, where does it actually say that? And then you get into this whole rabbit hole. I think we've mentioned it for the past couple of weeks on the trot, actually. This sort of issue of, if you're the DPO, you know, where do you start looking if you're told that there's this legal obligation that sort of like a unicorn and exists somewhere, then you've got to go and find it. It can be quite tricky. But I'd agree with what's being said in the chat thus far. I'm trying to keep up with it. There's been a real flurry in the last couple of minutes, so I do apologise. But people saying that, you know, basically, get on top of it, start compiling it. I'm interested, I wanted to come back to Ben's take. Ben's saying that they're going through a merger at the moment, and he's made retention archiving one of the day one items, mostly to establish what is there for data maps and make sure it is managed well from the off. A review of historic paperwork will begin a few months in. Which I think is interesting, because there you are, and I certainly don't want to put words in your mouth, Ben, but I feel like you're almost inverting the proposition there and not saying this is some, you know, massive task and we'll get to it and we get to it. We don't really want to deal with it. You're sort of flipping it and saying, no, this is a really valuable way of looking at things. is actually a good springboard for us to go and look at the wider compliance or the wider maturity of the organization from a compliance perspective. So let's sort of build on that and let's go and really take a look at what you've got in place, which I think is a fabulous approach. It's not one that I would champion personally, just because, as with some, I'm sure the thought of a big retention task does still strike fear into my heart, if I'm being completely honest, but only because I've had to deal with some real
stinkers in the past. I quite like what he's doing there. I think going through a merger would be an ideal opportunity to take stock of what records you're needing, what records you need to take forward as a merger to create. I assume you're creating some sort of new company, whatever. You know, what records do you need to keep forward to keep going with what you're doing? What could be archived to show the history of the individual organisations and history of the merger if you need to keep anything? And making it as part of that, I think, is really good because, you know, at that point, if they've got a lot of stuff from both organisations that doesn't need to be carried over, if they're, you know, merging and joining systems and stuff like that, they might be able to cull quite a lot of stuff.
So no, absolutely.
I think that's quite exciting. I'd probably try and do similar to Ben, you know, put it in and make people think about it. You don't just merge it all and then have twice the amount of stuff when
a lot of it might not be needed. Don't get me wrong. I think it's a fabulous approach. I just think it's daunting for a braver person than I.
I mean, yeah.
Can I come in and just provide a bit more context?
Yeah, please do.
Yeah, so the merger is between two college groups. Once we're fully merged, we'll be about 40,000 students per year. And both organisations have about 5 sites each, and some of our archiving is held off-site and a lot of it is held on-site. And for this organisation we're merging with, a lot of it is on-site. We've already got that agreement that they'll be adopting our retention schedule, so there's the ability to go in and look at everything which is there and start to apply those retention schedules. But it is being done in conjunction with that wider data protection merger plan and looking at privacy notices, looking at data sharing agreements and trying to start everything that is there. A lot of that core Article 30 paperwork we'll also be looking at trying to recreate from the ground up. So by going in and getting that understanding of what documentation exists, hopefully it will then complement those other plans and just allow everything to be done once. So while I agree with Oliver, maybe it's a little bit backwards to start with a dig through the paper when there is so much else that DPOs consider. Hopefully it will all work in unison.
No, only backwards according to my own interpretation, Ben. But no, I think it sounds like a really, really good way of going about it. And I mean, that's the thing, right, with these types of projects is there's no right or wrong way to do it, so ultimately the one that's good, that's most effective, obviously is context specific. And on that note, I suppose that mirrors what James is saying, which we have touched on previously but is incredibly difficult in this entire process, is that so much of it is down to either interpretation or at least necessity and how you interpret what is needed within the organization and being able to justify that, because so little is actually prescriptive. Even when you have good resources like the NHS retention schedule, it's not necessarily guaranteed that, because sometimes it will cite, you know, best practice, but where does that best practice come from?
Yeah.
You know, sometimes someone's mentioned it'll come from the IRMS. Sometimes it'll come from sort of, if we're talking education, NSPCC guidance, etc. You know, that's where it gets very difficult. Caroline mentions the Records Management Code of Practice 2021 for patient records. Again, fabulous resource. There are resources out there. There are a couple shared in the last chat, I believe. So we'll dig those up for those who weren't a bit able to attend last time. We'll put them in here so that you've got all of those. But I think we were discussing this the other week, Carrie, weren't we? Or was it earlier this week? I forget. I've had a couple of days off. My brain's gone to mush. But we were talking about safeguarding, right? And you very kindly helped me with a piece of work on that. And you were basically saying, I found all this.
That was it, I think.
How much I'm paying attention. But you're basically saying, you know, I found all this information about how long safeguarding records should be kept. But this specifically, these resources relate to the education sector. And you're doing it for a charity/housing provider. So I don't know whether it carries over. But I think, you know, while you're bang on there, there can be sometimes, and this is what we were saying, right? Sometimes it's just a case of, well, there is no better, at least to our understanding, there is no better resource. There isn't a more authoritative source for this retention period, so we're going to go and pinch one from a sector that is, you know, not our own, because we've got a lack of guidance. And I can't imagine that in any way that would be unacceptable. Maybe I'm wrong on that front.
I think as long as you, you know, if you, like, I think I suggested to them some council that I knew about and some school stuff. And yeah, I think as long as the information's broadly being the same, being kept for similar reasons, like safeguarding, you know, schools keep safeguarding, councils keep safeguarding, housing associations, charities might all do that, might all keep it for similar reasons, then it sort of makes sense that the retention period may be similar.
No, absolutely. And you can sort of then apply this sort of broader approach to it all, which I think is a very useful one. I think I've gotten to roughly the end of the chat. There's a lot of people asking for examples, and some people very kindly sharing really good examples, which I'm very grateful for.
Bella's shared the schools, the IRMS for schools, the education IRMS for schools. I loved that. When I worked with schools, that was like my little retention Bible. Anytime a school would come to me with a retention query, I'd be like, IRMS retention for schools, where is it in this document? It's very, if you've not seen a copy of it, it's very detailed. It goes down into very tiny detail about every record, like HR records, all of it, anything you might find in a school. They've created a retention schedule for it. It's really good resource, that one.
Yeah, and there's also a comment in here from Sylvian basically saying that the way to do it, and I completely agree with this, is to have your sort of get a starting point in place, even if it's a bit generic, even if it's just the standard, and then work through it on sort of an exception-led basis. You know, look at the instances where actually that retention period doesn't work for you for XYZ reason. Pick out those, as they say, anomalies, and then, you know, address those in due course, because that's the way to do it. And actually, this is one of the things I was going to raise, which is one of my sort of most common approaches to this type of task, is to really sort of go, I don't know how you would describe it, but it is basically to go potentially sort of too high level initially. So say we'll retain, so to take that safeguarding example, maybe we retain all information associated with a particular individual's file for 10 years because we made a safeguarding referral, and safeguarding referrals have to be kept for 10 years. Now, what you'll find is that a lot of that information is going to be over-retained. But if you've got nothing better, I think it's probably preferable to keep everything for 10 years instead of just keeping it indefinitely. And then you can sort of work your way down from that, right? So you go sort of really high level. Yes, a lot of it's over-retained, but gradually as you gain the maturity, you can start to bring the more granular elements within that type of record, that type of activity down. Say, well, actually, only the safeguarding referral needs to be kept for 10 years. The rest of it can kept for duration of engagement plus 6 years if you're going from the Limitation Act or whatever. Yeah. But you hear what I'm saying, you know, to really sort of take that approach and go through it bit by bit. Now, that does take a lot of time and maturity, but that is one of the...
But if you've got nothing in place, you could go from that very top level and be like, all safeguarding's this much, all HR is this much, all finance this much, all tenancy information this long. And then you could cull everything over those timelines instantly. Then you're left with a reduced amount of stuff, and then start digging into it in more detail of, right, well, what exactly do we need to keep for 10 years versus 5 years or 6 years? It's a, sort of a good way of starting it, you know. Whenever I see anybody holding anything indefinitely, I'm just like, really? In 1,000 years' time, you're really going to be holding that, are you? Probably not.
Well, yeah, there is also that. I'm curious about... Curious about Bella's comment here. IRMS is really good, but I found some difference of opinion with our legal advisors with regard to employment records, where the statute of limitation on contract breaches claims is 6 years, substantially longer than some types of document in the IRMS schedule. Sorry, reading out loud, that made more sense. I was trying to wrap my head around it. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what we're saying, right? Which is that sometimes you'll have conflicting guidance and conflicting opinions from within the organisation. And generally speaking, I mean, again, not to be too flippant about it, but we said this on the last session, which is to say, ultimately, your retention period should be however long you actually need it for. And as long as that's got a strong justification behind it, I'm happy to, well, not approve, because, you know, that's not really my job, but I'm happy to sort of sign off on a retention period which maybe seems a bit high to me, but at least has a strong justification against it, rather. Because if you're coming to me and saying, well, I need this for 10 years because X, Y, Z, and I can prove it, I'm like, okay, well, 10 years seems like a lot, but you seem to have a pretty compelling case, so fine, off you go. Mm-hmm. As opposed to sometimes it is just a case of we don't necessarily have anything to go off.
Yeah, and it is good when you sort of find guidance and stuff and they do identify exactly where they found it in the legislation. That's always really handy because you can track back and see, right, does it still say that? If you're using if you find some resource from like 3 or 4 years ago, you might want to backtrack and be like, right, well, they're saying it comes from this legislation. Is that still the case? It can be really interesting about that.
Yeah, I'm again curious about another comment here from David who says, does termination of contracts supersede the need to retain the data from a supplier of a service perspective? Now, if I'm misinterpreting your comment, David, then please do let me know. But I'd have said that termination of a contract really is a trigger for a retention period, isn't it? You'd have said that you'd have the data for the duration of the contract, and then from the moment it's terminated or it reaches its natural expiration or whatever, it's not renewed, from that moment on, it triggers a retention period. So if it's a contractual matter, you'd have said probably 6 years, right? As we're saying from that Limitations Act that we all rely on a lot. But that's what that is. I don't think it would necessarily be the case, unless you were told otherwise. Maybe if you're a processor and your controller has decided that, you know, you need to retain it for a certain period of time and you don't have a stronger legal justification, then you need to delete it. I don't know. I'd probably have to look at it in greater detail. But I just said that that's typically the sort of thing which would act as a trigger for a retention period, Carrie. What do you think?
Yeah, I'd have thought that if the termination of the contract, then you'd invoke whatever the retention section says of the contract. You know, if it says send all the data back and delete it, you'd do that. If it says to delete it, if it says to hold it for 6 years, you'd do that. I mean, that doesn't mean that you couldn't, you know, depending on why the contract's terminated, you know, that you may come to another agreement and get that in writing of, you know, we're actually going to vary from the contract and do this with it. You know, delete it straight away rather than holding it. But yeah, that's the way I interpret it.
So James says many contracts now have clauses demanding that records are deleted upon the contract ending. I think that's where Dave's coming from. So I guess what we're saying there is a conflict clearly, but what takes precedent in the case where if your client has contractually demanded that you delete data, does that supersede any legal justification that you may have for retaining it?
If you're a processor, then you would be keeping it as a controller if you kept it for any reason outside of the contract, wouldn't you? If you've got your own need to keep that data.
Yeah, I'd have said so. I think at this point it's important to qualify that I am not a legal professional and I am not qualified to give legal advice.
Me neither. So please, none of us are.
Please do not conclude contracts or take any actions based on what we're saying. but you know, interesting question. I mean, instinctively, I'd be tempted to say that because if you look at Article 28, now I know this is potentially slightly different. Oh, we're talking joint controllers. Well, that lobs another spanner in the works. But if you allow me to think out loud for a second, if we're talking Article 28, then clearly there's a provision there which says that you're only to protest data on the controls instructions unless there's a legal reason for you to deviate from those instructions, right? That's built in. I mean, I'm, you know, paraphrasing slightly. But clearly the law provides for that type of situation. Now, does that carry across to outright contract law? I don't know, to be perfectly honest with you. I don't know what would take precedence in that case. You'd probably have to look at the wider composition of the contract and see how that's built, particularly sort of around the liabilities. But as I say, please don't take any action based on what I'm saying here, because this is based off of some very old contract law lectures. I kind of want to move away from this topic because I feel like I'm just digging a hole.
Let's back towards records management a bit more.
But it's a fabulous question, guys, so thank you for raising it. And you know what, I might go away and think about that a little bit. And if I come to any conclusions between now and our next episode, then I will fill you in. But on that note, I did want to talk a little bit about... So there's a few things still I wanted to pick up on, which is really... There are a couple of things. So one of the things I wanted to talk about was the different types of approach that I've taken to getting retention started, to getting the ball rolling. And I'll fill you in on what I mean by approaches in just a second. But also, one of the things that I wanted to raise at this juncture, because by the sounds of, well, we have you, first of all, Carrie, but also we've got a few people who have a records management background on the session today. And I was curious as to the perception of what is easier, at least not what is easier, but what's the best place to start when you're talking about retention? Do you cover it as an overall records management task within the business? So you go above and beyond personal data, you look at all of your records. Or would you be tempted to isolate it to personal data and say, well, actually, let's start from here because that's got more of a statutory backing to it. I don't know. I don't know if one's necessarily easier than the other. And if there's a better or worse place to start, or if it's all really just the same. In the notes for this session, I use the very clumsy terminology of personal versus non-personal information, where to start. So apologies for that, Carrie. But I don't know. Do you have any insight on that? Does anyone on the session have any insight?
I mean, this is why y'all keep on saying that I'm the expert, but actually I've not done much records management program stuff myself. Like, I've done it as part of my master's degree, but then I went straight into data protection. So I haven't had much experience of this myself. For me personally, I think if I was going to do this, I think I would just break it up into service areas and tackle both sides. If I was going to do it, may as well do both at once. You know, tackle the personal data and the non-personal data assets and see what's, you know, I'd probably start with an audit to sort of see what's there in the first place and then whittle it down from that. I was going through some of my old sort of coursework notes from uni. It's quite interesting, one of the things in it that sort of says you need to look at it from two sides. So go from the top-down approach of, well, what do you think your organisation's doing and what's it, you know, what kind of thing is it doing? You know, have a top-down analysis. And then go from a bottom-up approach of what are you actually doing? And see, figuring out, you know, do they actually agree with each other? You know, is it that the top-down approach of thinking you're doing something, can you have these types of records? But then the bottom-up approach is like, actually, we have these types of records. And what, you know, sort of try and unpick exactly what processing activities are taking place to then apply retention to them.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I mean, the only reason I ask the question is because obviously when I'm working with a customer, I'm engaged as a DPO. And so the objective of that is get us to be compliant, or, you know, if I'm working as a consultant, get us to be GDPR compliant. So when it comes to retention, I'm sort of like, well, you know, your obligation as a GDPR is to only retain personal data for as long as you need it. So let's look at that and let's ignore, unless it's relevant or useful, and I'll come to this in a second, let's ignore wider information assets until we have to, because from a risk management perspective, if you're engaging me on the basis that I'm looking purely at the GDPR, well, I'm not too interested in any other types of record, quite frankly, because that's what I'm being paid to do, which is perhaps a little bit narrow, and generally speaking, I wouldn't put it across in those terms, because obviously we'll look at it as a broader task. But, you know, sort of the sort of voice in the back of my head is sort of saying that, if you like. I think Ben again makes a very good point, which is he says he goes with what exists, and where there is motivation to get things sorted as a DPO, personal data is important, but look at what is labeled and which departments are most willing to engage, which is a really, really good point, because I think one of the things that obviously we all come up against is that there are certain departments who are basically, you know, an open door. You know, they're ready to, you know, purge things. They're really sort of keen on making sure that we're, you know, above board. Some of them will already have a lot of it in place sometimes, because, you know, we've mentioned HR and finance tend to be pretty hot on that sort of thing, because they have very clearly defined periods associated with it and generally more guidance, maybe fewer records. But some of them are going to be a lot more of a battle. And I think that's a perfectly sensible approach to say, well, actually, let me just take a look at, you know, for want of a better term, where the quick wins are going to be. And also let's match that up against maybe our risk appetite and some of our broader risk management efforts. And let's see where we need to start. I think that's a perfectly sensible way to do it. I do agree with what Charlotte's saying, that you have to do it as you go, because otherwise it becomes overwhelming. I think that's kind of what we were
It's always difficult to get people to actually engage with retention fully, that they have so much other work going on their plate that they might not see retention as also part of their job. They might think it's somebody else's responsibility to deal with the retention aspect, and it can be difficult to get that embedded in teams to, you know, no, you do need to consider this, you know, as you would everything else. And so, you know, going with the quick wins, you know, dealing with the teams who are more motivated, then at least you can get some of it done. You know, you can figure out your best methods of doing it with those teams who are actually willing to engage and willing to test out different methods and different processes of getting it retained. And then maybe once you know the best way of doing it, take that to the teams that are being tricky and say, "But this, we've figured out this is the best, most effective way of doing it, and this is how we're doing it."
No, for sure. For sure. Another very, very interesting question from the chat, which, well, or sort of a statement, but there's a question off the back of this which Charlotte puts in. It's a question in their DPIA, what's the retention for the new data you are collecting? And that's a very good point, because I suspect that all of our DPIAs, if not, you know, a very large proportion of them, will include that question. But how often is that sort of, you know, actually acted upon? How often is that synergy there, that you do a DPIA and then off the back of the DPIA that processing activity goes into Europas, the retention period is logged in Europas, it then maybe goes and you cross-reference it with any retention schedules that you might have separately, and then it's enforced properly. I assume there are plenty of organizations that have a maturity level that do that, but I don't see a huge amount of that happening. It's generally a case of, oh, well, it's retained for this long, or we don't know how long it needs to be retained for, and therefore that's logged as a risk maybe, but there's not necessarily that, you know, a follow through to really sort of go and log that as your retention period on a retention schedule and apply that in practice. It's sort of just sort of, you know, left the ether.
Thought about on the DPIA because it asks about it, and then people tend to then forget about it a little bit afterwards. But this is where it's like, you know, if you start it off when you're a small, young organisation, you know, if you get everybody on board with it and understanding it from the off, then you wouldn't come up against these problems in theory later on, because you should always remain on top of it. You wouldn't end up with a backlog of stuff that you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah, for sure. And a number of people in the chat basically commenting or sort of confirming the idea that one of the number one struggles with all of this is buy-in from asset owners across the business, because there's no way that the DPO or the privacy officer or whatever the title is going to be able to manage it on their own, and they shouldn't be expected to. You know, those teams, those individuals should have accountability for the data that they're responsible for any processes that they own. But I think part of that has to come down to, there's probably a training element there, but also maybe a regularity to it, which would help. So if you're instituting this as your standard process, if you're building it into change management processes, for instance, that, you know, the retention period has to be determined, it has to be signed off by the DPO, or it has to be reviewed by the DPO anyway, it has to go on the records, it has to be applied, etc., and you're doing it as you go along, as we're saying, that probably helps things a lot, because then that asset owner doesn't feel like you're coming to them sort of once a year with this massive bulk of work and saying, oh, by the way, it's time to review all of this. Because if they're doing it as they're going along, it's rose-tinted specs, I appreciate, but I think in an ideal scenario, that's probably the way to do it.
Yeah.
And probably a training element as well, so they actually understand what's being asked of them. Because all too often it's, oh, yeah, time to update Europas. And people go, what?
Yeah.
not a clue.
That's when you start having like hour-long meetings with them to help them understand it and fill it in, because they haven't done it in 2 or 3 years and they've forgotten all about it.
Or people have moved on and, you know, the roles have changed. So it is incredibly difficult, and that's part of it, and it's part of the challenge, I suppose. But then really the way to remedy that is to come up with an overall strategy, I'd have thought, an actual, you know, documented and granular process for all of this that goes beyond just, we've got a retention schedule and we try and apply it, which, you know, we're all guilty of sometimes.
Sometimes you might get lucky as well with this, actually, with retention. You might be able to force it onto people if you're changing the systems. I know one of my clients is doing this. They're changing to put everything, I think they're putting everything onto the cloud, onto SharePoint, and so they're having a massive sort through of everything, and only the stuff they're keeping should be going on there. So if you're changing to a new system that's going to sort of fundamentally change about where you're keeping stuff, that can be used as a good opportunity to get people to really look at the data they're holding and what can they actually get rid of.
Yeah, any opportunity like that, any opportunity where you're going through sort of a more significant change, whether it's systems, whether it's processes, whether it's just anything, restructuring the business, even if it's appropriate at that juncture, you know, take that opportunity to have a look, have a bit of a clear out, a bit of a spring clean of any records that you're holding. I'd just like to champion David's approach, who says that he keeps reminding information asset owners that there is no corporate pot to pay for any fines that comes out of their budget, which I'm sure motivates more than a few. But yeah, sort of any opportunity, as Ben's saying, you know, their move to SAN from SAN to SharePoint gave us the opportunity to delete terabytes of forgotten files. I mean, it's anything like that, right? Just having a clear out. I mean, we spoke last time about the cost associated with storage, which is something which I wasn't necessarily well versed in. So there were a couple of interesting points in there for those that weren't with us last time. But because it's an argument that often gets, you know, trotted out, is that storage is expensive, and I wasn't necessarily convinced that was a real threat, but turns out I was misinformed on that point.
I think it's a good one to use as well if you're trying to get buy-in from senior leadership teams, from board. Well, you know, if you stop spending all this money on useless storage to store files that are way past retention, you could have that money for something else.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So there's plenty of ways that you can go about it. I'm just conscious of time. We've hit our allocated mark, but obviously I'm happy to stick around a little bit longer as we've been doing recently. We'll probably have to start scheduling these meetings to run a little bit longer in future because we tend to start late and then overrun. But we'll come to that. I've got to put together a proposal with producer Miles as to how we can improve things around it, which if you would like to contribute to, everyone in attendance here or listeners to this retrospectively, let us know how we can improve things around here. You know, we're always looking for feedback and opportunities on how we can better this space. And I say Miles and I are working on a more formal proposal on that at the minute. But yeah, as I say, there are a couple of things I wanted to cover off which I've not really gotten an opportunity to talk about. One of the things we've kind of spoken about it really, but basically the different approaches that you can take to managing this project, to, you know, how do you actually get the ball rolling? So one of the things that I talk about is an asset-led approach versus a processing activity based approach versus a systems-led approach. And again, it's kind of all different ways of branding the same issue, but how do you start applying those retention criteria? So in certain organizations, I've taken, as I say, the systems approach because they have a limited number of systems which have quite limited uses. Therefore, it's easy to say, right, well, anything in this system is retained for 6 years, anything in this system is retained for 4 years. And that gives us a good jumping off point effectively to start from. In other organizations, because maybe they've got a certain level of maturity with these things, you take the asset approach. So say, right, well, you've already got all your information assets logged, you've already got all their purposes against them, let's go from there. Or alternatively, sometimes it's a case of, well, we've finished compiling your ROPAs, it's the first time you've done this sort of thing, so maybe now we look at your retention, but let's look at it on sort of a case-by-case basis with processing activities, which isn't ideal because often the granularity is not there to do it properly, but, you know, where else are you going to start? Those are sort of the three types of approach. I haven't had time to talk about them, but I've just run through them there pretty quickly. Those are the sort of the three. I don't know if that sort of echoes your experience, Carol. Maybe I'm thinking about it in perhaps sort of quite an odd way there, but those are sort of the three types of approach I take to the task.
Yeah, I think if you're starting it from scratch, I think doing the system-led approach first can at least give you that overview of basics, but then I would probably go into potentially like an asset led approach, but I'd take it piece by piece, pick off different areas at a time.
Yeah, which is what we mentioned at the start. You start high level and then work your way down, and you acquire that granularity during the sort of cycle of the project. And as someone mentioned, you know, maybe work through on an exception basis. So we keep this for 10 years. Oh, well, no, that doesn't work because X, Y, and Z.
There's no fast and easy way through it.
No. One thing I was curious about, although people are having to jump off, so maybe I've brought this up too late because I wanted feedback really from everyone on the session, but I was wondering whether anyone had approached this from the perspective of working sort of from the lawful basis that you're using. You gain consent for a particular processing activity, and because that consent lasts a certain period of time, we keep things for this particular period, or maybe if you've got a legal obligation, we go find a statutory period, or even if you're relying on a legitimate interest, you know, when you're doing an LIA, maybe you consider the proximity to the individual, maybe you consider the duration of the relationship, and that informs your retention period. Feels like a convoluted way to do it, but I was just curious of whether anyone had ever sort of experimented with that at all. I suppose it kind of ties in to an extent to what was said about DPIAs and sort of moving from that approach. Is that something you've ever even conceptualized, Carrie? It literally only came to me as I was writing the notes.
I think that could actually be a really interesting way of doing it, because the legal obligation stuff, right, well, there's got to be something in statute written down. So you could pick that off very easily, and that's some very black and white, you know, evidence you could give to service areas saying, right, you know, the law says you can only keep this for this long, delete everything from before this date. You could actually pick off some areas quite easily with the legal obligation aspect, and then with consent, you say, right, well, everything that we haven't re-gotten consent for in the past, whatever, that needs to go. Mm. Could be an interesting way of doing it. I mean, the only thing is you're going to get, that's only going to be as good as what your ROPA is.
Yeah,
exactly. You're going to end up, ROPAs, there's always going to be something that falls through the gap.
Yeah, 100%. Ben's saying they use that for only when they're adding to their existing retention schedule, which makes sense. It would be nightmarish to try and compile an entire schedule on that basis. Just to pick up, because David makes a very good point, he says, you know, be a little cautious about starting with systems. In his experience, the same system will have records in it that will have different retention periods, maybe for legal reasons. I would start with the IARs, ROPAs, and the retention schedule. And I completely agree with what you're saying. My point being that if you're dealing with a maybe a smaller business that has very sort of specific systems that do one thing, and it is possible to apply that one retention period to that system, that's sometimes a way of getting some quick wins on the board. But I completely hear what you're saying, which is that, like, it's generally not going to work for your email system or maybe a CRM, because there's going to be all sorts in there. Certainly not going to work for, you know, 365. You can't say you're going to apply, you know, a set retention period to everything in 365. But if you do have the sort of more niche systems, those more niche activities, it's just a couple that you can maybe cross off early doors.
Or you'd maybe go through and work out which is the most longest retention period and apply that, on the understanding you're holding stuff past retention, but that, yes, you're going to tackle that once you go down into the further detail.
Yeah, which is precisely what I've done in the past with an organisation, is to say, well, let's look at all your systems. Let's look at what's in those systems. Let's take the maximum retention period associated with those assets in the system, and therefore that's going to be the max retention period for anything in that system. So even though a lot of stuff's going to be over-retained, at least we're going to start filtering out bits and pieces, because there are things in there that shouldn't be in there for that long. And then let's work our way back down. As we've said previously, let's look on an exception basis through other records. And that gives you at least a starting point. It's not necessarily right or wrong, but that's what I have done with an organization in the past, because it made sense for them. And I guess this is kind of what we're saying across the entire subject, is that so much of it is situation specific, right? Yeah. So much of it is case by case basis, because there's going to be no one size fits all retention period. There's going to be no one size fits all approach for an organization or even for a specific activity. So you've just got to go case by case and try and ensure that granularity, I suppose.
You just got to go in and do your best.
So as per usual, our response is, it depends.
Which I know nobody wants to hear, but if anybody comes up with a very easy, nice way of doing retention, please let us know.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, on that note, I say we've run over a little bit, but happy to keep chatting if anyone's got any specific points or questions they want to raise. I agree, David, does come back to making information asset owners accountable, making individuals accountable, because otherwise you're going to be on your own and facing an uphill battle. Mira says, difficult for small organizations, as it would be nice to have standards to follow rather than think about everything in huge detail. Yeah, so I guess that's what we're saying, right, is, you know, take a basic premise to start and work your way down gently. There's no need to I think there's no need to rush in and decide in one go that everything has to be kept for this uber granular retention period. I think if you start from, you know, if you have a good example to begin from, so we've talked about some good resources on this session, and just implement some of the more easily accessible retention periods within that and start to work your way down, perhaps. It's a good way to do it. Good way to do it. So I think people are gradually starting to filter out. Carrie, you and I have to go and record an intro for this before our next meetings, respectively. So we will go and do that. But thank you very much for your time and insights this afternoon, Carrie. I enjoyed that, albeit I felt desperately underprepared this morning. I think that was still a really, really good chat. And I'll tell you why it's a good chat, because of all of our fantastic subscribers and people who attend week in, week out. We couldn't do it without them. They're the ones that really keep all of this.
It's the chat that helps build the content for the whole podcast. Keeps going.
That's the secret. So thank you all very, very much for your time. Thank you for attending. We really enjoyed that one. We are back again next week. I don't think we've had, well, I suppose we were technically off last week, but a pre-recorded episode went out. If you didn't hear that, then that is available across all audio streaming platforms, on our social media, on the DPP website, etc. You can find that. Next week, we are talking, I'm not entirely sure what we're talking about next week.
We're back with GDPR Radio next week, Ol.
Back with GDPR Radio, thank you, Producer Miles. So that's an informal open surgery type session. So if you've got anything that we didn't talk about this week that you want to cover, then come along to that, ask the question, or just broadly, it's a good opportunity to have a nice little chat about all things privacy. On that note, I will let you all get off, have a lovely weekend, and we will catch up with you soon.